Please be seated. So before we start the argument, just wanted to say a few words. First, thanks so much to the high school and to all the students for being here for Law Day. Really appreciate that. I hope you get something out of this experience of watching appellate argument. And also wanted to just thank, I'm not sure if anybody's here from the Chavez County Bar Association, but they put a lot of effort into this event also, so we appreciate that a lot. And to counsel for traveling, you know, usually the farthest you'd have to travel maybe would be an hour or two, and I know both of you traveled longer than that, so really appreciate you being here. Just so you know what to expect this morning, we're going to have the arguments, and then the three judges, we're going to go out for a few minutes and talk, and if we can make a decision in that time, we will come back and announce our decision, but if not, we may not do that. We may end up giving our decision in writing later. But then after that, we'll all be here, and I understand the lawyers have kindly agreed to be here as well for to answer your questions and talk to you all about anything you want to talk about. So with that, I think we can start. Yeah. All right, we're here this morning for oral argument in the case of City of Farmington versus Howell, number 42673. Counsel, if you would please enter your appearances. Thank you. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Adam Howell was convicted of resisting arrest for standing on a public sidewalk, recording the police in the public performance of their duties. During the first several minutes of that encounter, he was given rapid and contradictory instructions, some of which were intended to unlawfully hinder the free exercise of his constitutional right to stand in public, gathering and broadcasting the news. This court should reverse Howell's conviction for three independent reasons. First, Officer Boyd's order to Howell was a flatly unconstitutional order intended to prevent his ability to film. It was unenforceable, and it cannot be the basis for resisting conviction. Second, to the extent that Officer Boyd did have grounds to restrict Howell's right to film, those restrictions needed to be objectively reasonable, time, place, and manner restrictions. Officer Boyd's order to cross the street was not a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction, and it wasn't supported by any other officer on scene there that day. And third and finally, there's just not evidence that Mr. Howell actually failed to comply with any clear, repeated, uncontradicted commands. Mr. Howell was told to step back twice. He stepped back both times. He was told twice that he, by other officers other than Officer Boyd, that he was fine right where he was, right on the same side of the street as the investigation. No officer on scene told him that he was risking arrest or that he was violating the law by not crossing the street after he was told he was fine where he was. No officer on scene told him, or no officer on scene made the decision to arrest him there that day. Officer Boyd didn't go swear out a warrant for him until the next day.
What about the initial series of orders from Officer Boyd, though? They were the initial, my apologies.
Sorry, it's loud in here.
Let me get this a little closer. I wanted to ask you about the initial series of orders from Officer Boyd to go across the street. Those struck me as clear, consistent, and at that point, close to a minute went by, and the defendant did not comply. So why isn't that enough? Just looking at that snapshot of time, why isn't that enough?
I think for that point, the question also becomes, when is it a request? When is it an order? If this were the Fourth Amendment context and an officer were asking, hey, can you do me a favor and open up your trunk so I can take a look? This court would never, ever interpret that as an order. If I were to open up my trunk and let the officer take a look, you would say that I waived my Fourth Amendment rights to resist to demand a warrant. In this case, when Mr. Howell first approached Officer Boyd, she very clearly said, hey, do me a favor, can you cross the street? Hey, can you cross the street? By the time she escalated to, I need you to cross the street, within 16 seconds of that first order, Officer Young said, no, you're fine right where you are. The second time she ordered him across the street, again, it was within 19 seconds. Sorry, I'm backwards. The first time was 19. The second time was 16. He ordered Howell, hey, can you take a step back? And Mr. Howell did. From that point, after he took that step back, the officers may have been unhappy with where he was. They certainly testified in court that they didn't think he was complying with orders. But nobody told Mr. Howell that. The most recent order he received was take a step back. He did. And then no officer talked to him again until 10 minutes later when Sergeant Blaya asked him to step back again. He did again, and he was told again, okay, now that we're here, you're fine.
Counsel, go ahead.
So just to follow up on that, so to make sure I understand what you're arguing, is that when you're looking at when a clear and concise order is actually granted, one of the things we also look about is the enough time to comply. So you're saying within that 16-second period, then kind of receiving confusing questions or orders, but then ultimately complying, that was within a significant enough time frame to consider compliance?
I think, and I'm sorry, I'm just having trouble hearing here. I think the position is that when he's receiving different instructions from different officers, it's not unreasonable for him to take a beat, to question what's going on, who's actually giving the orders, which orders do I actually need to follow, what's a question, what's an order. I have found no case law that finds that failing to comply within a matter of seconds constitutes resisting, especially when this court's prior cases that uphold resisting convictions for failing to comply with an order are safety situations. They're, hey, you need to leave this parking lot. There's an altercation. They're, drop the knife. There's no case I've found where an officer tells someone you need to step back, and if they don't instantaneously comply, that's the crime of resisting arrest.
I just wanted to push back on one of the facts that you said. You said that Officer Young said you're fine where you are, but what I have is the quote, you guys aren't doing nothing wrong. And those seem to me to be two different things. Are you saying in the record that Officer Young told Howell he was fine to stay where he was on the sidewalk? Or am I right that it says you're not doing nothing wrong?
We may be placing different interpretations on the words. Your quote of the words is accurate. He said you guys aren't doing nothing wrong.
And my ultimate question for you on the facts is, aren't we to view these in the light most favorable to the verdict, drawing all the reasonable inferences? Isn't what you're talking about whether the order was clear, a question for the fact finder? Why would we be answering that question when the fact finder has already found it to be true that it was a clear order?
The standard of review is drawing all reasonable inferences in favor of upholding the verdict. Could any reasonable fact finder have found beyond a reasonable doubt on all the elements of the crime? Here, I think we have video. We're not asking, the defense isn't asking the court to weigh one officer versus another officer or versus Mr. Howell's testimony. We have the video. We can see what happened. If this were something like State v. Diaz, where the officers followed the defendant down the road 150 to 200 yards, shouting over and over again, drop the knife, drop the knife, drop the knife, certainly that's in the realm where a reasonable fact finder could find that he was given clear orders and he just overtly refused to comply. In this situation where we have video evidence that he was told cross the street, and seconds later, Mr. Chi said, we're not doing anything wrong, and the officer agreed, you guys aren't doing nothing wrong, and didn't tell them to move, no reasonable fact finder could find that they were disregarding an order. Later on, when Officer Boyd says, cross the street, and Officer Young says, "Never, just take a step back," and they do, and no officer tells them again that they're wrong, no reasonable fact finder could find that that's objectively, overtly refusing to comply with an order.
Please continue.
Okay. So in this case, really the question in terms of the lawfulness of the order is whether Officer Boyd's order was objectively reasonable, an objectively reasonable time, place, and manner restriction. Historically, this court has viewed public streets as public forums. Not just this court, the U.S. Supreme Court, circuit courts that have analyzed this issue have held that public streets, public parks are places where free speech rights are at their zenith. In this case, there's no evidence that anyone else not holding a camera would have been diverted off that sidewalk. There's no evidence that someone walking a dog by would have been told by police they weren't allowed to walk a dog by the front of that car. What happened was Mr. Howell, because he was carrying a camera, was given a lesser right to be on that sidewalk than someone who didn't have a camera. That's not an objectively reasonable restriction.
Well, we don't know that because the only people on the sidewalk from the public were Mr. Chi and Mr. Howell. So we don't know how the officer would have treated somebody who was just standing by.
We don't necessarily, but what we do know is that officers absolutely know how to close off a crime scene to the public if they don't want the public there. Police officers put up crime scene tape around places all the time. In State versus McCormick, they put up no trespassing signs to keep the public and journalists out of an area of the website that they didn't want people in. If Mr. Howell had crossed a crime scene tape, passed by a no trespassing sign, I don't think there's any debate that he would be here on a trespassing charge, if nothing else.
So let's assume that that the officer sees the situation. She wants to talk to a person who's agitated, and she says, before I talk to him, let's put crime scene tape around this block. Are we in a different situation there? She's free to do that, but she can't tell him to leave.
I think we're in an entirely different situation there because crime scene tape would block off the public in general. In this case, Your Honor is correct. We don't have evidence about what someone else walking down the street would have happened, but we do know that the only person who was diverted off that sidewalk was someone with a camera. If they'd set up a perimeter, blocked off the entire public, we would know that it was because they wanted no one in that area. In this case, the evidence that we have is that they didn't want to be recorded. They didn't want the camera there. Officer Boyd, at least, was very explicit about that when she said, you need to cross the street, he doesn't want to be filmed. And she charged him in the arrest warrant affidavit for refusing to stop filming, which escalated Mr. DeLuzio.
Let's assume that Mr. DeLuzio had a gun in his hands and she could observe the gun from her position outside the vehicle. Is she then free to tell Mr. Howell to go across the street because of the danger she perceives, or does she have to go set up crime scene tape?
I think it's a different situation than where we are now. I think someone shouting gun, gun, gun is a totally different situation than, hey, this guy doesn't want to be filmed. In general, I think what's important to keep in mind is obviously everyone should be safe. Safety is important. But police have more jobs than safety. Police have the job of ensuring that everybody's constitutional rights are protected. They have the job of ensuring that Mr. DeLuzio's rights are protected. If they arrest him without cause, they're going to be subject to suit, rightfully. They also have the obligation to ensure that the public is able to exercise their right to record, to broadcast, to protest, to shout if they want to. In City of Houston v. Hill, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case that found that police are expected to be able to deal with the public, that's a case where the plaintiff in that case was actually shouting at the police explicitly to interfere with their investigation, explicitly to try to distract them. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, we understand that, but he had a First Amendment right to do what he did. In this case, if the police needed to call him backup, which they did, that's fine. That's their job. That's not evidence that someone's doing anything wrong. In McCormick, they didn't just put up some no trespassing signs and call it a day. They put up no trespassing signs, and they had 40 law enforcement officers on scene to try to protect everyone's right. And the person who got charged was the person who still couldn't follow the law to not pass the no trespassing signs.
So just to clarify, so you are telling us that with the facts of this case, that we know that law enforcement was being told that there might be a gun. They confirmed in talking to Mr. Lozio that there was indeed a knife. He is in control of a very large vehicle, which could also potentially be a weapon. That any kind of security concerns that they had in that moment in terms of keeping themselves safe, Lozio safe, and perhaps even your client safe in that scenario, are we supposed to dismiss that for the First Amendment right to record?
I don't know that the answer is we need to dismiss that, but the answer is we need to keep in mind the order of operations here. Mr. Howell's not convicted for generally interfering with the scene. He's not convicted for making a safety risk, and he's not responsible for Mr. DeLuzio's conduct. He's responsible for being given an order and not immediately complying with that order. So the question isn't, was he causing a problem? The question isn't, was it unsafe? The question is, looking at the facts that were available, would an objectively reasonable officer have felt it was necessary to order Mr. Howell all the way to the other side of the street? And we know from at least two other officers on scene there that day that nobody supported the order to cross the street. It just wasn't an objectively reasonable order.
So in construing what lawful discharge is, because that's one of the elements of the offense, are you suggesting that there's a reasonability question that needs to be answered within determining whether the officer's in the lawful discharge of her duties?
I have not found a case exactly on point with this in New Mexico. I think the best place to look for this is Hawaii versus Russo, where the baseline they put out is if the police want to convict someone with a crime for disobeying an order, they first need to establish that that order is lawful. They didn't do that here.
Do you think we can analogize to cases that are charging aggravated assault against a peace officer, because there the same language is used, lawful discharge of the officer's duties? Those cases seem to me to be instructive. That's Penman, that's Tapia. Should we look to those cases? If not, why not?
I agree. I think those cases, in terms of battering a peace officer, assaulting, actually being a physical threat to an officer, don't require the officer to necessarily been lawful at that moment. They just have to generally be in the lawful discharge of their duties. And this makes good public policy sense. If an officer is arresting me, I don't think it's lawful. I shouldn't get to shoot back at the officer. We should all go to court and talk about that. This is a different situation. Mr. Howell's not accused of creating any safety danger. No one was trying to arrest him. No one was trying to bring him under control. He was trying to exercise his constitutional rights, and someone simply ordered him not to. That's an entirely different situation. To turn back to the Fourth Amendment context, the Tenth Circuit, looking at Story versus Taylor, held that if a police officer can't go into someone's house, they can't order that person out of the house, then it can't be resisting arrest for the person to disregard an unlawful order ordering them out of that house. The same situation applies here. Officer Boyd didn't have the right to order Mr. Howell to stop filming, so he shouldn't be convicted of resisting for not complying with that unlawful, unconstitutional order that she wasn't authorized to give in the first place.
Counsel, you were talking about Russo, and one of my concerns with Russo, the Hawaii case, is it discusses the statutory language in there, and it talks about specifically the failure to comply with the lawful order of the police officer. Here we have resisting the lawful discharge of an officer's duties. And it seems to me that those create slightly different narratives in how we want to move forward in handling this case.
They do, but I think it emphasizes that in Hawaii, they actually had a statute explicitly on point that said simply refusing to comply with an order is a crime. We don't have that in New Mexico. We don't have any case law I can find where simply not complying with an order to stop recording constitutes a crime. I couldn't find any case where simply not complying with an order to step back might be a crime. The cases we have in New Mexico that support a criminal charge of resisting arrest all deal with some sort of safety concern. They deal with drop the knife, leave the scene of the disturbance. In State v. Wade, this court found that it wasn't resisting arrest when someone was just shouting at the police, get out of my house, because police need to deal with people shouting at them. That's part of their job, to deal with people expressing their First Amendment rights loudly and passionately at them. That's all Mr. Howell was doing, except he wasn't even all that loud about it. He was just standing there silently recording.
It sounds like your position is that the order needed to be actually lawful. In other words, if the order itself did not comply with the First Amendment, we figure that out after the fact, then the defendant can't be convicted. Am I getting that right? Even if the officer was acting in a general way reasonably, if the order turns out to be unlawful, no conviction.
That is my position, yes. I think it makes public policy sense. In the battering a peace officer context, it makes total policy sense that we don't want anyone resisting arrest. The point is to get you in front of the judge, and you can argue the lawfulness of the arrest in front of the judge. In this case here, the alternative to get in front of a judge would be for Mr. Howell to say, okay, you're right, put down his camera, drive to the courthouse to see if he can get a TRO issued before that traffic stop has ended. If officers are permitted, if they're otherwise lawfully on scene, to just order people, hey, stop recording, and that person's only recourse is to go to the courthouse, those officers can effectively prevent themselves from ever being filmed. And that can't be where the public policy balance lies.
And I appreciate that. I guess I wanted to ask about the another side of the public policy's sort of safety part of the balance, which is, should an officer have to have a nuanced understanding of the First Amendment in order to figure out exactly what to order a journalist to do in a given situation, or a citizen who has a right to report also?
First of all, yes, they should have nuanced understandings of all of the Constitution. We expect them to have a nuanced understanding of the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment. The Second Amendment. There's no good reason why they shouldn't also be expected to have a nuanced understanding of the First Amendment. The other piece of that is looking at where the risk lies here. Someone who's not fully advised on their constitutional rights, probably best advised to just listen to whatever the officer has to say, because if you get it wrong and that was a lawful order, you're resisting a conviction for a crime.
So if that's a test that in order to be convicted of this crime, you have to show as the state or the city that the officer's in the lawful discharge, and one of the ways that a defendant can defeat that is by showing that the order is unlawful, who decides that question of lawfulness? Is that the judge? Is that the jury?
In a case like this, it probably should have been the judge at a motion hearing. However, in general, I don't think it's that difficult to give this to the fact finder. One of the elements already is finding was the officer in the lawful discharge of their duties. And I don't think it's that difficult to maybe tweak that element a little, maybe give a special instruction saying the order must have been lawful. In this particular context, in this case, here's how you would assess if this complied with the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, whatever issue is being at issue in that particular case.
And you, go ahead. I was just going to ask you, you're raising something that I was confused about in the record, which is this came up inside the bench trial as part of an element versus a motion to dismiss. And it sounds to me like you're saying it can be raised maybe in either way. If it happens the way it did in this case, which is it goes to the fact finder and you're creating a jury instruction, what guidance do we give to juries to find whether an order is lawful or not? Is it reasonable? Is it reasonability? Is it time, place, and manner? How do we build that instruction?
With your Honor's permission, I'm actually going to backtrack a little and answer the last question because I thought of a better analogy. I think this is a good case, a good line of questioning where we can analogize to the battering a peace officer situation. In a battering a peace officer trial, one of the elements, as always, was the officer in the lawful discharge of their duties. This court's case law, the Supreme Court case law, indicates that is probably usually a judge question. That's probably something that usually needs to be raised beforehand and is usually something the judge can handle. That doesn't mean there isn't a situation where maybe this is close enough to the line that in this particular case, the parties need to draft a jury instruction to instruct the jury on what that would mean in this case. Similarly here, I don't think it would have, I wasn't the attorney below, but Mr. Howell below probably should have filed some sort of full and font motion on the lawfulness issue before it got to trial. But that doesn't change that once it's at trial, whether or not the officer was in the lawful discharge of their duty is not Mr. Howell's burden to prove. That is an element that the state is required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and that this court is required to find that there was substantial evidence for a reasonable fact finder to find beyond a reasonable doubt. In this case, there isn't that evidence.
So just to quickly follow up, because I did have a question about the record. We received a couple of exhibits that didn't seem to be included in the record, and to include a motion to dismiss. Do you know how that came about or why we have that?
I know that they were on the flash drive. I was also confused by them, and I don't know how those got into the record.
So just to clarify, as far as you're aware, that actually wasn't given to the trial court at any point?
If it was raised, my assumption would have been it must have been a municipal court, because I don't have full access to their records. I didn't see it in the record anywhere for the district court.
And then just to follow up, and thinking about the idea that we would have a judge make the determination, do we need to have an agreement on the facts for the judge to make like a legal determination?
I think that's going back to the battery and a peace officer context. In most cases, the facts relevant to whether or not the order was lawful aren't going to be that in dispute, I don't think. In this case, the facts aren't in dispute. There's multiple angles of video of what happened. In your average battery and a peace officer case, whether or not someone did the shooting, whether or not they were the actual suspect, whatever may all be issues for dispute, whether or not the officer was lawfully on scene at all isn't something that there's usually a lot of factual dispute on. So I think, yes, if there's dispute about the facts, that's probably something that needs to go to the jury. But in the majority of cases, I don't think that will be the case.
Should it be like a situation where, you know, a motion to suppress under the Fourth Amendment, there can be potentially all kinds of factual disputes. Those typically go in front of a judge, and there's a suppression hearing, and the judge finds the facts that the judge needs to rely on to make the legal call. In a situation like this, you have some dispute because the video doesn't show what she's seeing inside the car. It doesn't give us what she's concerned about. There's some dispute about how far he is. Should that be in a hearing to decide whether the First Amendment is implicated here?
And Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. May I answer the court's question? I think the answer is turning back to this mechanism that we know very well, which is full and font motions. We routinely have issues where maybe the parties want to debate some of these facts at trial, but for purposes of getting the legal issue decided, a party will submit a motion, say, pursuant to State versus Full and Font, we're stipulating to these facts for purposes of this motion only. Can you please help us with the law, judge? And I think that something similar could have been done in this case. It could be done in any case involving the First Amendment, where maybe there are factual disputes that need to be addressed at trial, but we can at least distill it down for purposes of the Full and Font motion to here's the agreed-on set of facts. Defense thinks this isn't good enough. State thinks it is. Judge, can you please rule on this purely legal issue at this point?
Did you reserve any time for rebuttal?
I reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay,
great. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for your time. Listening to the arguments and reading the briefs prior to today, Your Honors, has left me honestly a little perplexed. And I understand that Mr. Howell and Mr. Wadsworth want to make this a case about the First Amendment, and I respect that. But to set the fact scenario here, I agree that a journalist has an absolute right to record. And they have an absolute right to record the police. That is well settled case law for the United States Supreme Court that New Mexico courts have recognized. But what they don't have a right to do is create dangerous situations for individuals and disobey lawful orders, which is what happened in this situation. The courts have routinely held that under First Amendment right, you can set reasonable restrictions in time, place, and manner. In this situation, to set the scene, I don't know if you've seen the video or not of the case, but you have an individual who's called in as a person with a weapon who's known to have some potential mental health struggles and has threatened his former attorney, and the attorney has called in for a call for service. You have an individual who's an officer who's rather slight in stature, who is dealing with an individual who is armed because she sees the weapon inside the vehicle and is trying to maintain this person who is incredibly agitated to keep them inside the vehicle, to not only keep herself safe, him safe, but also Mr. Howell and Mr. Chi, who were there, safe. They were at the front of the vehicle on the sidewalk. They were simply asked multiple times as Mr. Howell was going, shh, 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 being disrespectful to the officers and disobeying their order, to step across the street, across a maximum 50-foot wide street, to the sidewalk across the street for officer safety, for their safety, and for Mr. DeLuzio's safety. That is a lawful order. That is a reasonable restriction under time, place, and manner. There are Supreme Court cases where 100, 250 feet have found to be reasonable, that officers have asked the media to step back from a crime scene. What I heard Mr. Rodsworth argue today is that they could have set up crime scene tape. They could have set up some sort of no trespass signs. It's practically unreasonable in this case, Your Honors. This was an active scene where they were responding to an active call. It was not a crime scene where, unfortunately, somebody had lost their life or somebody had already been beat up and the scene was over and they were investigating and dealing with. This was an active scene with the individual at the scene. They don't have that luxury of setting up crime scene tape. They don't have the luxury of setting up no trespass signs. As the city attorney who represents officers, I would appreciate if they had that opportunity, but that's not the reality of this situation. The time, place, and manner restriction that Officer Boyd asked Mr. Howell and Mr. Chi to follow was more than reasonable under the case law that has been established under the Supreme Court. In reference to the lawful order idea, he is arguing that...
Counsel, I don't want to interrupt you, but I wanted to follow up on something before I forget that you...
I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing with the air conditioner.
I said I didn't mean to interrupt you wholeheartedly, but there was something that you mentioned, so I wanted to make sure I follow up on before I forget. In terms of talking about ensuring safety, right, when she goes up to the vehicle and she sees the weapon, and in understanding that we are supposed to look at the facts most favorably to the trial court, I do understand that. I think that there's two ways that we can interpret what happened after having viewed the video. One way, right, is she's trying to control the situation, that she wants to ensure that everybody's safe, that she doesn't want this person that she knows who has mental health issues and is potentially dangerous because he's had a history of that, right? Like, she's trying to control the situation. And by asking Mr. Howell to cross the street is one of her attempts to try to make that a safe situation while understanding he has the right to record. Another interpretation is that before anything happened, she had already asked Mr. Howell to cross the street. And then Mr. DeLuzio immediately started becoming reactive when we don't know if he would have been reactive but for her asking the question in the first place, right? So I know part of the conversation or the discussion on this is, well, Mr. DeLuzio became reactive and this escalated and it elevated and it became a safety concern. My question is, would that have ever happened? Or we don't know if that would have happened if the officer just hadn't said anything in the first place and just let him record from the public sidewalk.
I hear your question, Your Honor, and I think unfortunately with how this fact scenario is, I'm not sure we will ever really know the answer to that question because we unfortunately can't go back and replay the incident as everybody was feeling that day and the circumstances that happened that day. What I can tell you is based upon the testimony from Officer Boyd and based upon watching the video, Mr. DeLuzio was already making comments and actions that he was very annoyed and very agitated with what was going on in front of his truck, which was Mr. Howell and Mr. Chi. Prior to Officer Boyd making any announcements that, hey, can you guys please step back? He's not wanting to be recorded. And to make something clear as well, Your Honor, Mr. Wadsworth is arguing that Officer Boyd told them they could not record. That is factually untrue. She never said those words. She asked them to step across the street. They could still continue to record. Officer Young never said, what you're doing is okay. He said, you're fine recording, but he never said that you didn't have to follow Officer Boyd's argument.
Oops. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Please, Your Honor.
I just wanted to ask a little more about the specifics there. So Mr. DeLuzio did not want to be recorded. That was what was agitating him, as I understand it. So why would moving the camera across the street decrease his agitation? There'd still be recording. So I guess I'm wondering, what's the connection between the order and the safety concerns that you identified? Safety is undoubtedly important, but I'm just trying to figure out how the order is connected to safety.
It's a connection in the sense that it gives the officer time and distance to deal with it with a matter. When you have an individual who's agitating, an individual who's already maybe not rationally reacting to things appropriately, time and distance is a key factor in de-escalating situations. It's a key factor in force not having to be used. It's a key factor in things not escalating. And them being 50 feet away versus 5 to 10 feet away is a substantial game changer in reference to safety for Officer Boyd, for Officer Young, for Mr. Chi, Mr. Howell, and Mr. DeLuzio. That is the exact connection of why it was.
And what about the in relation to the distance, what about the audio, the argument that the defendant makes about, you know, being that far away, I couldn't effectively capture the audio, which was an important part of the interaction?
I don't know if they couldn't have captured the audio or not, Your Honor, because I don't know how good their cameras are. I don't know if their cameras would have picked up 50 feet away. That's not something I can guess to, that I would have to speculate as to that. But I would anticipate that if the Supreme Court has said that 100 to 250 feet away is a reasonable time distance and manner, 50 feet across the street is considered a reasonable time distance and manner.
And just to quickly follow up on that question, because the briefing discusses the fact that defense counsel didn't cite anything regarding audio. Of course, the reply brief points out that multiple cases also include audio as a First Amendment. Is that still a position that the city's taking?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I couldn't catch part of what you said. My hearing is terrible. Lots of concerts.
I apologize. I'll try to speak up. So one of my questions in the briefing, which we know that you did not write, but in the briefing, it notes that the defense counsel didn't cite any cases specific to audio, but we know multiple cases that he cited to does include audio. Is that still a position that the city is taking, or should we dismiss that?
I would dismiss that argument. If I had written the brief, I would have taken a different tactical approach to be professional in it. I do think audio is recognized by the courts, but I also think we have to look at the fact that the courts have held that a substantial distance, which will probably prevent you from getting audio, has been ruled constitutional for a time, place, and manner restriction.
Thank you.
And I appreciate the candor and the concession. Do you also concede that to show lawful discharge, there's a reasonable aspect to it, that a lawful order necessarily turns on the reasonability or the reasonableness of time, place, and manner, which you're mentioning, the risk that the officer is perceiving? Do you agree that that should be part of what makes an order lawful or unlawful?
So I agree in this sense, Your Honor. I agree in the sense that if it is a situation where there is potential First Amendment right matter being involved, not just a, for lack of better terms, straightforward standard resisting case that we normally see involving law enforcement, because this is definitely not one of them, that under First Amendment case law, under that analysis, the order has to be reasonable and the restriction on time, place, and manner has to be reasonable. And that articulation, that factor, should be considered by the judge in a First Amendment case that involves a resisting or some other crime that involves an order by an officer to determine if it's reasonable. I would argue in this case, Your Honor, that the order was reasonable. She didn't ask them to stop filming. She didn't ask them to leave the scene. She asked them to simply step across the street, which is a smaller distance, what the Supreme Court has ruled is a reasonable distance to create under time, place, and manner restrictions.
I appreciate all that, and you got to several of my questions there, so I'll go. No, that's great. I appreciate it. The next question I have is, if in this case, it doesn't seem like a motion or the framework was queued up for the district court judge to decide lawful discharge and lawful order in the way that you two seem to agree today. Whose fault is that? Should we send it back for the judge for the parties to do this again? Or should we say, you know, defense, that was really your obligation to queue up that issue. And so since you didn't, we're not going to get to it.
I would argue to you that because defense did not queue up that, I wouldn't say that it wasn't dealt with, it wasn't argued in the trial at the district court and the municipal court. I was not the one who argued the case, but I was there. So I watched the trials. I'm very familiar with this case. I wouldn't say it wasn't argued, but I agree with you that ideally it would have been an appropriate motion to dismiss. It should have been a separate motion practice. That should have absolutely been filed so that there is a clearer record on the arguments made and the fact that it was dealt with. Unfortunately, that did not happen in the lower court. That's not the city's responsibility to make that argument, obviously, because we're not going to file a motion to dismiss our own matter, our own case. That would be defense. I would argue to you that based upon the litany of case law, that the names are slipping my mind and how the court has approached those matters before, that it's not reversible error because it was argued in the lower court. It just wasn't motion practiced, and therefore the court probably should not address that matter in this case.
No, you go.
Just to follow up on that, one of the things that at least I find difficult in this case, right, is the lower court just says, well, this isn't a First Amendment issue. It's not even close. I have no understanding why the judge said that, right? And so that's why we're asking that question, right? Like, is this a send back with a test to have the court do? Is this a send back for findings and conclusions? Just something so we're not, we're all looking at the video. We're supposed to do it in a favor, but we don't know what findings, what he was actually thinking. We don't have jury instructions like this went to a jury, right? Like, we're trying to kind of figure this out in the dark.
And unfortunately, we won't have jury instructions because it's a municipal case, so they're not entitled to a jury trial, which I am eternally grateful for. I've done jury trials. I understand what you're saying, and when I was heard that comment, I cringed a little bit as a professional and as an attorney, because I was like, not probably what we want to be saying as the judiciary and as a judge. I can't comment any further than what the comment was on its face. I don't know what the judge was thinking. That wasn't further explored. I can't answer for him. I don't think, though, that it rises to the level of reversing the case and sending it back for an analysis. I think there is enough information in the record proper, enough information that was developed at trial, that your honors can look at to determine if the restriction in the order was reasonable in time, place, and manner under Supreme Court case law and under New Mexico case law, and whether the officer was within those reasonableness restrictions.
I wanted to follow up too on my colleague's question about fault and was this sufficiently raised by the defense. It's a sufficiency of evidence argument on appeal, and ordinarily those don't have to be preserved. There was a First Amendment argument made, so it seems to me like it's properly presented on appeal for us to consider. What do you agree with that, or is there some argument other than preservation that we should be thinking about as to why we would just avoid the issue entirely?
If I heard your question correctly, should you avoid the issue of the First Amendment entirely? I do not think you should do that, Your Honor. I absolutely think that is something that should be considered, but I think the record and the facts were developed enough that you can look at that information, and the briefing developed it enough that this court can make a rational, reasonable, legal-based decision on those factors. But I absolutely do not think it should be disregarded. That is very much a foundational issue in this case, because Mr. Howell is an independent journalist and he does have a First Amendment right, as everybody else in this room does. In reference to the sufficiency of the evidence that you brought up, Your Honor, I would argue to you that based upon the record and the testimony that was presented in district court and the video, there is more than enough sufficient evidence to show a resisting charge. You have lawful commands. They're given clearly, directly. They're not conflicting. There's a failure to comply with those lawful commands. Those are the elements of resisting. There's plenty of evidence that was presented on that for sufficiency of the evidence to uphold the conviction in this case.
What's your response to the other side's argument that we should look at the whole interaction, the initial requests or the initial statements by Officer Boyd were really requests? By the time there was a clear order, very soon after that, the defendant did take steps back, so that if I understand the defense's argument correctly, if we look at the entire scenario rather than just a real quick snapshot at the beginning, there was some compliance. Initially, they were requests rather than orders. What do you agree with any or all of that?
I agree with some of it. I think you have to take the surrounding facts into consideration, but I think you also have to look at the behavior of the individuals involved in the situation. In many cases that I'm sure you guys have seen in your careers that have come before you as judges and that you've handled as private attorneys on maybe not resisting cases, but other cases where officers are giving order, and you know, a Section 1983 case or New Mexico civil rights case, officers typically, when they give orders, make requests first to try to de-escalate the situation. That doesn't mean you don't have to follow it.
Would it have...
She escalated to an order, yes. During that entire time, if you look at Mr. Howell's behavior, he was non-compliant. He finally decided to move as the interaction was coming to an end.
And I guess the part that I'm struggling with a little bit there is those couple of initial statements, they were phrased in a way that made me think compliance is optional. I'm asking you to do me a favor, you know, words to that effect. So I guess I'm wondering, is that clearly an order in the way that someone could be held criminally accountable for, or is it a little too ambiguous, like, is this officer requiring me to do it, or is it more, would you please do me a favor and move across the street?
Your Honor, I definitely see your point. In my view, in looking at it, if an officer is kindly asking me to do something, I'm going to consider it out of the order, and I'm going to do it. I'm not going to debate. I'm not going to say, oh, well, maybe they don't really mean it. I'm going to do it. Eventually, it escalated to an order, and even if you have concern about the conflicting, seems like a request, and then it was an order, even if you segment those off, there were direct orders given, and there was a non-compliance to multiple direct orders given.
It seems like defense counsel makes a really good point about the Fourth Amendment in analogizing to a situation where an officer says, do you mind if I look in your trunk? Can you do me a favor and pop your trunk? We're not viewing that as an order, and whatever was found in there would be deemed a consensual search. That seems to be very similar to the situation we have here when she's, can you do me a favor? Can you go across the street? What do you say to that? Should we be persuaded by that analogy?
I think that's a fair argument and it's a fair analogy, but it forgets what happens after those two requests. There are multiple direct orders given that Mr. Howell does not obey. Whether we want to see those couple statements, let's use the word statements, as requests, okay, I'll give that. I think that's a reasonable interpretation. A rational mind could see it that way. But a rational mind, in my view, can't see the three or four orders after that that he refuses to comply with, and he's going shh, shh, shh as compliance. And they are direct orders.
So one of the things that I keep thinking about is, however we write this is going to dramatically dictate, right, police interaction with people who want to record what they're doing. We have to focus on the facts of this case, right? We can give you tons of hypotheticals of crazy things that are happening, and you're going to keep telling us, well, this is what we have in this case. But I'm trying to balance, obviously, officer safety and wanting to make sure that they're not being disrupted in what they're doing. And somebody who is standing, I think the debate is 3 to 8 feet, right? Like, is standing several feet away, just trying to record what's happening. Because there's a public interest, right, for police in both scenarios. What if the suspect said the officer did something that they didn't do? Well, now they had someone who recorded. Also, you have an officer who did do something wrong, and now it's recorded, and we don't want to prevent that. But when we're dealing with kind of a passive resistance, and I agree, the shushing's rude, right? It just is. Like, there's no way around it. But Officer Boyd also testified at trial that he wasn't being aggressive. So you're, like, in this balancing of, like, how do we deal with passive resistance as a whole, if that makes sense.
It does. And if I don't answer your question because I'm not computing it with what you want, please tell me. I would argue with you that this is passive resistance. I think this is actually, it is not physical resistance, but there's different forms of resistance that aren't passive that don't involve a physical altercation between individuals. His failure to comply, him saying, I don't have to move, I have a right to record, you can't tell me what to do, him shushing her, that's an act of resistance. That's not passive. That's actively resisting a lawful order. In reference to the bounce, I don't envy the fact that you have to write this opinion. I'm glad it's you and not me. But in relation to finding that bounce of public interest in resistance and officer safety, I think you can go back to the time, place, manner restrictions, the reasonableness of it. He was asked to move across the street. He was never asked not to record. He was never removed from the scene. He was never prevented from recording. He was simply asked to move across the street, which is at a maximum 50 feet away from where the scene is actually happening.
Do you agree with your friend on the other side that we shouldn't import cases like Tapia, cases like Penman, that deal with lawful discharge in the aggravated assault on a peace officer context into a context like this, where you don't have physical resistance, you don't have a physical assault or a battery on an officer. Instead, what you have is a passive, for a lack of a better word, refusal to obey an order. Should these be different tests, or should we be applying the same tests from Penman and Tapia?
I think for internal consistency and the fact that a lot of the times the facts are very similar in those senses, they should be a guidance to the court. I don't think you completely ignoring them and creating a whole separate test on a passive resistance, which I think can create a high probability of confusion and argument on what test applies, would be an appropriate course for the court to take.
It sounds like you agree with what I think the other side is saying, that in this context, lawful discharge turns on whether it's a lawful order, which turns on reasonableness. And that some of the factors that are at play there are time, place, manner, the situation that the officer is encountering. All of those things go into that question about reasonableness, which ultimately drives, was the order lawful, and ultimately that element.
In a sense, Your Honor, yes, but I think it's a separate analysis in the time, place, manner restrictions on whether the order was lawful or not. I think that's done under a First Amendment analysis, and then the lawful discharge is done. The facts of the case are done separately from that First Amendment analysis that involves our journalist recording. If the order is found lawful, you could still have a situation where an order is found lawful in time, place, and manner restrictions, but you don't end up having a resisting because the order wasn't given correctly, or it wasn't a clear order, or there wasn't an order given at all, and the officer ends up filing a charge. Those are not the facts in this situation, in my view, but I think they're a different analysis, and they don't necessarily get combined all into one.
I guess I want to clarify that point a little bit too, because like Tapia and Penman, as I read them, say that part of the test for whether the officer was in the lawful discharge of their duties is whether the officer was acting reasonably. And so to me, it's folded in. This question of reasonableness is already part of our case law and what lawful discharge mean. That's how I read those cases. And so related to what my colleague asked, should we be using a different test than reasonableness under Penman and Tapia, the way that those courts applied reasonableness? Those were Fourth Amendment cases. This is a First Amendment case. Should there be a difference? I mean, is the fact that it's the First Amendment and there are other interests at stake that are bigger than the individual's interest, right? Society's interest in knowing what the police are doing and how they're interacting with people, et cetera. Chilling effect, things like that are very specific to the First Amendment. Do those change how we should think about this?
I don't think they change. I think what happens is you still have that analysis, but I like to look at it as a layer, kind of like when you have zoning maps and you have an overall layer over the zoning, and then you have specific zoning within that layer. I look at the Tapia analysis and those lineage of cases as the analysis you use of reasonableness, but then you layer on the First Amendment analysis of the reasonableness of time, place, and manner restriction. And then you move on to the Tapia analysis of whether the order was reasonable, which you've already partially answered at the First Amendment analysis layer that's layered on, because there is that specific kind of issue or specificity in that case and in this case. And then you move on to the rest of the analysis of the test that the court has established in Tapia in that lineage of cases.
I think that helps. I understand that. And so So following that one step further, so that would mean if the order itself was determined to be an unreasonable time, place, and manner restriction, excessive under the circumstances, that would be the end of the case, and the defendant would be acquitted. Is that?
I would agree in that matter, because if you have an unreasonable time, place, manner restriction order, and it involves a First Amendment right, under how the case law is established, that ends the case, because you have a violation of the First Amendment and you don't have a lawful order.
And procedurally, how should that come before a district court? In a motion to dismiss, full and form motion, like the other side suggests, that you ask the court, look, they're charging my client with this conduct based on this order, and I'm asking the court now to find that that order was unlawful because it's an unreasonable restriction on time, place, and manner. You cue that up in basically a motion to dismiss before the merits of the case in a trial.
Procedurally, if I was a defense attorney, I've never been one, so it's trying to put me in a mindset I've never been in. That's what I would have done to make the record clear. I still think it was argued in the district court in the sense the arguments that were made to the judge. But to make the record clearer, I think it would be preferable to file a motion to dismiss. But even if a motion to dismiss isn't filed like it was in this case, I think it was still dealt with at the district court with the arguments that were made. But it would have been ideal to file the motion to dismiss with the response, and it would have been much clearer of a record for the Court of Appeals to look at and determine what had actually happened. And in response to the record, I have no idea where that motion to dismiss came from. I was flipping through my file trying to see if it was in my file, and it's not in there. So I really do not know where it came from, Your Honor.
I just wanted to ask you the same question that my colleague asked the other side, which is, do you know why that motion to dismiss was on the thumb drive that we got? Because it doesn't look like it was part of the record proper.
I do not, Your Honor, and it's rather baffling to me. I actually, when I get back to Farmington next week, I'm going to call the district court and find out exactly why that was transmitted, because I looked through my file to see if it was in there, because I was like, oh, I was a little surprised when you asked, so I was like, oh. And it's not in my file either with all the documents I have, so I'm not sure, but I'm rather curious as to why and how it appeared. So I will call the district court and try to find out, but I am at a loss as you are, Your Honor.
I think I don't want to speak for the court, but just my own thinking is that it would be helpful to know. And if the parties do agree that this was considered by the courts, that would help us, because then we would know that it could be properly considered by us. So I
think that is a very reasonable request, and I would agree to that, too, Your Honor. It's rather perplexing. I do not have any further argument.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before I launch into the rest of my rebuttal, I do want to start with that point on preservation. I was not the attorney below. This isn't how I would have handled it either. However, that doesn't mean the issue is unpreserved, and that doesn't mean this court can't hear it. The First Amendment was at issue through this entire case. Mr. Howell cited it to the officers on the side of the road. At the end of the day, whether or not this order was lawful is an element that the state was required to prove. Whether the defense files any motion, whether the defense moved for directed verdict, the state was required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this officer was acting in the lawful discharge of her duties, which I believe the city just conceded means that this particular order was lawfully given. So I think that issue is properly before the court.
And here, counsel, you're in kind of a strange situation, too, for us, because this is a bench trial. And so, you know, maybe we could do that on a jury trial where it's gone to the jury already and nobody's really asked for this First Amendment issue to be decided. But here, I think your point's well taken, that the judge is both making legal and factual calls throughout this case as presiding over a bench trial.
Right.
But we don't have the benefit of factual findings. And so did defense counsel below request the judge to make factual findings on the First Amendment issue? It sounds like maybe no motion was ever filed. Is there any request?
The most I can give you is that there's no record of that request ever being made. I don't think it was made because it's not in the record, but I don't know.
So if we are stuck with an unclear factual record on findings that go to the First Amendment, What do you think the remedy is for that? Set out the test, remand for new trial, so that it can be, so that the judge can actually consider these things in the first instance and make findings for us to consider?
I in this particular case, because it is captured so well by multiple videos, Officer Boyd's video, Officer Young's video, and Mr. Howell's video, I don't know what benefit additional factual findings by the district court would have brought to this court here.
For one, we don't know whether the cameras would have captured audio from across the street, because those questions weren't asked. And I'm sure there's others about the scenario, what kind of restriction was being placed. Maybe that camera he was using is amazing and can capture audio three blocks away. We don't know any of those facts.
I think that brings me nicely to the second point I wanted to make, which is burden of proof here. We don't know that the camera couldn't have captured audio across the street if the city wanted to prove that Mr. Howell's camera was good enough that being across the street didn't make any difference. It was the city's burden to prove that. What we can say for sure is that Mr. Howell being moved all the way to the other side of the street, where potentially cars would have been driving through between him and the traffic stop, undoubtedly would have impaired his ability to record the scene. And burden of proof, I think, is important throughout all of this. The law places the burden not on Mr. Howell to decide what's best to not interfere with these officers. The burden is on the officers if they want him to move to give clear, repeated, uncontradicted commands.
Which counsel, that brings me to my question about an understanding about the factual findings in this case, right? If we're to look at, you know, where you say the 16 seconds and then Officer Young says you're not doing anything wrong. Well, you're arguing to us that's a conflicting command versus the opposing opinion, which would be, we're just saying, well, you're not doing anything wrong by filming, but that doesn't mean that we're saying that you're not doing anything wrong by not crossing the street. We don't know how the trial judge interpreted that command and whether or not it was conflicting or not. I guess we could assume that he didn't think it was conflicting, but we don't have that kind of, you know, factual findings to understand where he played out in this analysis of whether or not the commands are reasonable.
In this case, the constitutional issue, whether or not the law, the First Amendment protected Mr. Howell's conduct, is reviewed by this court de novo. I don't think whether or not the trial court below thought how Officer Young's order should be interpreted would necessarily bind this court. Because what matters isn't how the trial court viewed that order. What mattered was how Mr. Howell viewed that order, how a reasonable person would view that order. I think the reasonable interpretation is of you're not doing anything wrong is you're not doing anything wrong. But at a minimum, I think a reasonable interpretation is that that is related to the recording. If the officers wanted to make clear, and I see that I'm out of time, may I finish my answer? If the officers, starting at the beginning, I'm polite to people because it's polite all the time. If the officer wanted to make a request to be polite, to de-escalate, totally understood. But if she wanted to hold Mr. Howell criminally liable, the burden was on her to make clear that it was a command. Once Officer Howell or Officer Young stepped in and said, no, you guys aren't doing nothing wrong, the burden was on Officer Boyd to turn around and say, yes, yes, you are. You aren't crossing the street. When she said, cross the street, and Officer Young stepped in and said, no, just take a step back, the burden was on Officer Boyd to say, no, stepping back isn't enough. You need to get across the street. The city's argument here only makes sense if you take Officer Boyd in a vacuum. Mr. Howell was looking at two officers giving contradictory instructions, and the burden was not on him to figure out which officer was on charge. The burden was on the officers to be clear and to make sure that they weren't being contradicted. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both. We're going to go in the other room for a couple minutes, and then we'll be back out to talk with you. You all have other places to be pretty soon, so if anybody has questions, just feel free, raise your hand, and let's talk. Yes.